Nick and Nat's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
Hey, we're off! Not now, Natalie, not now! All right, so here we are. Welcome to Friday's Five Star Family Fun Size Fan Club with me, Nick Helm, and, of course, my co-host,
Nathaniel Metcalf.
Very excited today. You're listening to Fan Club. Very excited today. I ordered a Subway salad off Deliveroo about half an hour ago. Hasn't arrived yet. So there might be a moment where either, depending on how adventurous my delivery driver is, he'll either drop it off in reception. He'll either require me to go down to reception, which will take a couple of minutes, or he'll deliver it to my door. And if he does that, then there should be very little break in quality entertainment as Nathaniel takes over for me. But I think it'll be fine.
It's going to be fine, Nick.
What are you going to say, Nathaniel?
Well, we've got options, haven't we? We could play a song. I could just keep talking.
We're not going to... Why do you... Come on, Nathaniel. Why do you always default to play a song? You can do it.
Because I'd be talking, well, not to myself, to the listeners. But it's like talking to myself.
Well, do you know what? On most radio shows, it is to the listeners. But on this particular one, it would be talking to yourself.
Yeah.
First rule of Fan Club, of course.
Tell your friends about Fan Club.
I've been telling my friends about Fan Club for... What, two years now?
The only problem is
my friend's Nathaniel. second rule of Fan Club is, please, for the love of God,
tell your friends.
Tell your friends. How are you, Nathaniel? You seem a little bit, what's the right word, laconic?
Laconic? No, I'm pretty good. I'm just sipping on a coffee. So I'll be perking up anytime now.
Anything particularly of any interest before we get into stuff?
I was going to ask about how is your salad now late? Was it due? Did you get a time, an estimation?
They said it would be here at 1:45.
1:45. Okay, so it is late.
I mean, this is confusing because this is Wednesday's lunch. I've had meetings all morning, and then I got off of one meeting and I ordered food as soon as I could, said it would be here at 1:45, and now it is 2 minutes past the hour. This was Wednesday at 2:00, so it's 2:02, but obviously if you're listening on Friday live, it is 2:12, but obviously if you just listen to it as a podcast, it's anytime you want, anytime you bloody like, it doesn't even have to be on the hour. That's what I would say. I've had a really boring week where he's here! He's done it!
Okay. All right, I'll take over. I don't know where he is, so Nick could now be away for minutes or seconds, but I think he is at the door. And actually, Nick is right. It would have been a ridiculous time to play a song.
I'm back! Sorry about that, guys! I'm back! Sorry about that.
That was exciting.
How did it go, Nathaniel?
Oh, it's horrific. It's terrible. I think we've been taken off air. I think we've been taken off air, Nick. I think that's I turned the air blue. Took advantage of the FUBAR name, and I fucked it up beyond all recognition.
Whoa! Do you know what? In all these years, I don't think I've ever heard you say the F word.
That seems unlikely, given that we're on FUBAR.
Even I say it's effed up beyond all recognition.
I did, sorry.
And on my worst day, I'd say flipped up beyond all recognition. But I've never heard anything like it, my friend.
I'll tell you something interesting about me. And I say interesting, boring. I think I've only had a Subway about twice, maybe once in my life. Didn't really take to it. And when I went to the Subway, I didn't know the rules of a Subway. So when I went in there, I looked at the board of sandwiches and I went, oh, I'll have one of them meatball ones, please. And it was like, I'll have that one, please, the meatball, whatever it is. And they said, sure, what do you want on it? And I was like, I don't know. What's in it? Like, what type of bread do you want? And it's like, I don't know. What's that? I want it to look like that. That's the one I like the look of. I didn't understand that you ordered it. You get to pick and choose what you want in it. I sort of didn't like that. I would have just rather, do you want cheese on that? Yeah, I guess. If it's in the sandwich, I'll have it. It's not bothered. Yeah.
Just to stop you there. You know the Pokemon? Is it Pokemon or Pokemon?
I think it's Pokemon.
You know the character Pikachu?
Yeah. Yeah, he's the main guy.
Is that because you collect them and it's like Pikachus?
Might be. I would have thought, though, it's a Japanese word. So maybe it doesn't happen.
I don't think so, mate. So carry on with your story about Subway.
Do you know Pokemon Go? Or Pokemon Go? The game where you look at it on your phone. I'm in that game. Or was, unless they've changed it. You could go to different locations and it'd show up on your phone. And one of the ones was, if you go to the location of Gosh Comics in Berwick Street, where I used to work,
yeah,
it would bring up a photo of Gosh Comics, and there was me with my arse in the window. Just like coming back, and you're just back in the window, and you could see me.
And you were moaning.
No, I wasn't moaning. You know, just essentially, I had my back to the camera in the window.
You know the Pokemon van was going by.
Yeah.
Thought, if I just stand like this for 45 minutes, I'll definitely make the game.
Yeah. Yeah. So you can see me, unless they've updated the picture, you can see me in the Pokemon or Pokemon Go computer game. Don't play it myself. Yeah. I'm not a big fan. Also, Subways. I once was in Holborn. Now known as Midtown to landlords.
Is it?
It didn't catch on. They tried to rename it Midtown. And I walked past the Subway in Holborn and I saw the incredibly iconic footballer Pele in there. And it was some sort of promotion and he was serving behind the counter. Lots of people outside. I was trying to work out what was going on. And obviously doing some kind of promotion. And Pele, who's, I'm not a football fan, but is an icon of the 20th century, stood in a Subway, stood behind the counter. And I thought, I hope he's getting a lot of money for this, because this feels beneath him.
Wouldn't it be something to do with the fact that Subway do like 6-inch subs and footlongs and meatballs, and he does impotence adverts. Wouldn't it be some sort of tie-in?
It could be.
He does something for erectile dysfunction.
He does. He's in an advert where he gets stuck, isn't he?
You want a footlong with meatballs, then.
That just feels like you're rubbing it in.
Maybe if he rubbed it in, he wouldn't have that problem. So, the thing is, you did it wrong, your initial Subway. I've had the worst Subway I've ever had has been in lockdown.
Oh, no.
Where, basically, if you're in an actual Subway, what would I get? I'd get an Italian BMT, and then I would get all the salad except for tomato, and I would get onion sauce, and I'd have it in a honey oat roll, right? That's what I'd have, right? And I'd have it toasted with extra cheese, right? That's what I would have. And then I would get a large post-mix tango, mm-hmm. with loads of ice, although now I would get a Pepsi Max cherry because they have that as an option. And I would get a baked packet of cheese and onion Walker's crisps. Yeah, that's what I would get, right? But I'm not eating like bread and pasta. I'm not eating carbs basically, but I'm not on a carb-free diet. If my mum is listening, I still eat carbs. It's up to me, right? Just because I made a decision at one point in my life doesn't mean that it still stands. Just because when I was seven, I said I didn't like tomatoes, doesn't mean I still don't like tomatoes, although admittedly I don't like them on my Subway, right? I just find them, you know, other people's tomatoes I find too much to deal with. I prefer any tomato I eat to be a tomato that I have prepped myself, all right?
If I go to a kebab shop and I have a kebab shop burger, I'll say, everything but tomatoes, please. Not a fan.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of them in, I have issues, all right? I have to be romanced with tomatoes, right? Can't just have a tomato up against the wall of an alleyway by the bins, you know. I've got to. The moon has got to be right. There's got to be plenty of basil or basil, and just a hefty dose of balsamic glaze. So I like. I've gone off. Right, so what we're saying, so yeah, so that's how I would have a Subway, right? Mm-hmm. So I was in lockdown and for some reason I wanted a Subway, which I don't really, you can make a sandwich at home, why would you bother? I've only ever had a Subway in a home environment when I was doing the Leicester Festival, and I was so depressed I went down to Subway, didn't even get fully dressed, ordered a Subway, went back, sat cross-legged in my hotel room, and then just ate that in one go, felt ill, went to sleep. I think Subways are fine. It's a sandwich shop. But yeah. I had a Subway in lockdown. And at the beginning of lockdown, they were just like, what salad would you like? And you had to pick, there's like 20 salad items. And they would only let you have three. Can you believe that?
It isn't having it your way, as they'd say in Burger King. It's having it in a way that we can manage, really.
If anything, it's substandard.
It suggests the idea that lockdown has somehow impinged their ability to have ingredients. Whereas actually what it is doing is saying, it's almost like we're currently operating on a subpar level by not having full ingredients, but that's on you. Whereas actually there's nothing really about the lockdown that suggests that they wouldn't have had their full deliveries of tomatoes, lettuce, cucumber.
I don't think they reflected that in the price either. I just had, what did I have? I think I had cucumber, lettuce, mm-hmm. standard, right? Mm-hmm. Then what you're left with? You're left with an impossible decision between olives, jalapenos, red onions, and sweet corn. And how on earth are you meant to make that? I wanted red and green peppers. But what's the point if you can't have red onions? Anyway, certainly don't bother getting it toasted. It takes longer and it's cold anyway when it arrives. So that was Subway. But I've lost a bit more, but I think I've plateaued in terms of weight loss. I've got I've got two sets of weighing scales. I had some old ones. Say again?
I was going to say, isn't that always the way, though, isn't it? Doesn't it get harder? You lose a bunch to begin with because your body's almost in shock. Like, it's all going to go. And then it's like, I think your body probably tries to retain some, doesn't it? Because it's worried.
I'm also putting on so much in muscle, Nathaniel.
Oh, yeah, I can see that.
That muscle has bounced right back. Well, it's not bounced back, but it's flexed right back, muscle has. It's right there again. So I've got two sets of weighing scales. I've got one, which is like the old ones with the dial. Mm-hmm. But that would change how much I weighed depending on it was never consistent. Mm-hmm. I could put it in the bathroom and it was sort of like, it was way too light. I was way too light. I put it in the hallway and then I was too heavy. And then it just depends what time of, not just because of me, but it just depends where you put it, on what surface it was. I couldn't get an accurate reading. But I got some electronic scales and they are accurate, but depressing. So now what I do is I get an accurate reading off the scales, the electronic ones, and then I stand on the old school ones just to make myself feel better so that I know how much I weigh in an alternate reality. But I haven't been eating carbs. But what I did was I really quickly ordered a Subway salad because they're not that expensive and you can just eat them.
Is your Subway salad essentially the filling of a Subway? Is that what you're getting? It's essentially a breadless sandwich.
Yes. Without cheese.
Okay.
Or bread. Yeah, look. It's all meat.
Oh, yeah. It looks like the stuff you get in Subway.
Well, it looks what they've done is they've made you a Subway. And then someone said, who's that for? And they said, oh, it's for Nick Helm. You know, he's just ordered the delivery. He said he wanted a salad, not a bun. And so they're going, oh, I wish you'd told me before I'd made up a roll. So they've scraped it all out into a box, yeah. And then they've given it a shake, right. And then they've gone, yeah, give him that.
Yeah,
that's what it is. It's essentially what they've done there. But it is, it's fine. It's lunch.
Oh, I'm sure.
You've got to eat regularly, otherwise... Otherwise, your body goes into starvation mode, and then it starts
eating itself.
It starts keeping stuff. So, in actual fact, sometimes if you eat more, you lose less. Just depends what you're eating.
Okay. What have you been a fan of this week, Nick?
Well, I'll tell you what I've not been a fan of.
Oh yeah, Subway salads.
No, I like. They're just really easy, and you know, I didn't have time to make anything.
They look quite nice.
It's a salad. You can't fuck up a salad, and there's so many. Well, you can. There's so many. You absolutely can. In fact, I regret saying that. But there's so many places where you just like go. I really fancy. All I want is a salad, and there's so, especially in lockdown, there's so few places that would just deliver one. Well, you just buy all the ingredients for a salad. Yeah, sure. I've done that. But sometimes you just want someone else to do it. And in those situations, I order Subway. I feel like Happy Gilmore. So that's one for the Happy Gilmore fans out there.
If we get money off Subway for this. We should have thought about this before. We've basically given it away when we could have.
Given it away. I'm not a fan of Joe Bohr. We had a writing meeting last Thursday.
Yeah.
Working on something together. Comedian Joe Bohr, warm-up man to the stars, documentarian, contrarian Joe Bohr. we had a writing meeting last week, and then he texted me later to say that he had COVID, that he'd just been tested positive for COVID.
Did he tell you in a way that's like, oh, I meant to tell you this earlier.
No. He was mortified. He was mortified because, you know, he had the tests like the day before or something, and then he found out after he'd seen me. And I was sort of like, you know, I feel like I've already had it, but I've sort of like been very cautious. So since I found out he had it, you know, I've been very frustrated and annoyed, but you know, a shag's a shag.
It does put a different spin on it though, if he saw you after he'd had the test, as if he was thinking, I might have it. I'll see Nick.
Well, I don't know why he's had the test. I don't know why, do you know what I mean? It's like, why has he had the test? So there must be a reason. But anyway, yeah. So as soon as I got told that that he had it, then all of a sudden...
You've got to have a test.
Well, I've got to have a test, but then all of a sudden I start getting, like, the sweats. I start developing a cough. I've got a fever. You know, I feel sort of, like, dizzy. And it's just like, is this the fact that I've got COVID? Or is this the fact that, you know... What do you call it?
It's like
psychosomatic, yeah. I mean, I know it's psychosomatic because I wrote to Joe, it might be psychosomatic. And he said, Googling psychosomatic. And I said, now, is this the right description? It's sort of like
It's sort of like a placebo, only how you feel.
Yes. It's a nice way of putting it.
But I couldn't remember the word placebo. So I had to remember the band. And then I was away. And I remember the band by going, it's Brian from Placebian.
I was once in a pub in Finsbury Park with my mate, and they had in, bear in mind, this would have been about, say, 2014, that sort of time, 5-6 years ago. And I was in a pub in Finsbury Park, and in the pub they had a pinball table. And they had like a vintage pinball table. And what amused me and my friend was it was a vintage pinball table for the movie Johnny Mnemonic. And it was such a small movie that it was weird that it had a pinball machine anyway. They obviously had high hopes for it, and they'd done a bunch of merch.
It was going to be huge, right?
Yeah, it was like previewed all that year as like one of the big movies. And it was Keanu Reeves off the back of Speed. And it was like, this is the next big Keanu Reeves movie.
Dolph Lundgren?
Sorry?
Dolph Lundgren?
Yes. It had a few bit in. Is Iggy Pop in it? I think Iggy Pop's in it.
I think Henry Rollins is in it.
Henry Rollins, maybe that's who I was thinking of. And I was amused that he was Johnny Mnemonic and had this pinball machine. And so when one of the barmen was playing the bar, I said, do you know anything about this Johnny Mnemonic pinball machine? I'm just sort of amused it exists. And he goes, yeah, apparently it's like a film. And the barman, of course, he's 20 or something. And he's like, yeah, apparently it's like a film from the 90s. He's like, oh, no, I remember the film. I just think it wasn't like a big enough film to have a pinball machine. He goes, oh, no, apparently the owner bought it off someone who was like a rock star or something. And we were like, could you find out who that was, please? And he went, sure. And he went back and he had a word with the guy who owns the pub. And he came back and he goes, yeah, apparently he bought it off a guy called Brian Molko from Placebo. And I was very amused that Brian Molko from Placebo, stuck in the era of his fame, had owned up until recently a Johnny Mnemonic pinball machine.
Maybe it was given to him as a gift from one of the stars.
Could be. Perhaps Henry Rollins.
Do you know what? Were Placebo on the soundtrack?
Oh, it could have been. Can you look that up, please, Natalie?
I think that...
A placebo is a medicine, a procedure prescribed for the psychological benefit to the patient rather than for any physiological effect.
I think, I think Placebo, in that era, either they were on the soundtrack or maybe their record label handled the soundtrack for Johnny Mnemonic, and it was around, I don't know, EMI, and they went, oh, we like that, and we go, we'll get you one. Maybe it's something like that.
Could be. Yeah?
But rather than the fact that Brian from Placebo was day one, queuing in a tent to get in, for days, to get into the first screening of Johnny Mnemonic, and he couldn't work out why he was the only one in the queue. But he
said, I'm doing it. You got Johnny Mnemonic on here Friday. Or is that the road? No, it's on here. Yeah, it's on here. Right. There's no one else here yet. So I'm number one. Yes. Yes. First in the queue. Pick my own seat. And then it gets to like Thursday morning and his second day camping. And he says, excuse me, is second on here, is it? Johnny Mnemonic? Yeah. Screen 4. So in screen 4 on Friday.
Almost beginning to think that people haven't played the pinball game.
Apparently, Natalie says you can buy a Johnny Mnemonic pinball machine for £5,495.
Not bad, not bad at all. That's exactly the sort of thing that I'll be buying next week. If this film is half as good as the pinball machine, then people are daft, right? People are bloody daft. If they're not in line to see Johnny Mnemonic. Hey, if it's half as good as pinball, then people are daft for not being here.
Nice question. Have you ever heard Brian Molko speak?
Yeah, it's always like that, right?
Yeah, okay.
It's weird, isn't it? Because in a way, Johnny Mnemonic was a placebo for The Matrix, which would come later.
It was, yes. Very good. Very good.
Anyway,
it is the kind of name that would suggest he would talk like that.
Hey, I said Bloody Daft. Hey, hey. They're Bloody Daft if they're not in line to see Johnny Mnemonic. Hey, this half as good as Pinball. Pinball down the wheat shift. Right?
Have you all seen our Brian Michael? No, he's outside the cinema. He's going to see Johnny Mnemonic.
It's cyberpunk. I know.
Natalie's now found a cheaper one for $4,497 with free delivery.
Snap it up. Free delivery?
Yeah, you bet.
I'd pick it up for that much money. Fucking hell. That's amazing. It's amazing value. The only thing is, where would I put it? Oh, I know. I'll get rid of my fridge. So fucking hell. So I had to go for a COVID test.
So you didn't get one sent to you. You went to... I thought they were all driving the other places.
I couldn't get one sent to me.
Oh.
Because I already had one sent to me. So I had to take a home test a week ago. And then I needed to get another one. Like, legitimately. I just had to find out whether I had COVID or not, so that I could hang out with someone. Then it turned out I was fine, so that was all right. And then I tried to get another home test because I was legitimately hung out with someone with COVID. They wouldn't let me have one because I'd had one already within the last fortnight or whatever. It wasn't very specific. I just couldn't get one.
It's silly rules, isn't it?
It's absolute fucking bullshit. I could literally do a test, send it off, and then give myself COVID on the way out the building to post it. It's like, it's fucking ridiculous. So I had to go to Enfield, which is, it's between 2.5 and 5 miles. I can't quite remember, but they were like different. So it's between 2.5 and 5 miles away from where I live. So I got a lift there from someone that could have COVID. And then I did the test and then I walked home, which took like, it was meant to take 2 hours, but it took me 1 hour and 25 minutes. So I smashed that. Meaning I probably didn't have COVID, but because I'm so healthy. But on the way, I touched every single traffic light sign and I touched my face and I licked my fingers. So I may well have COVID since. It's just fucking like you're not allowed to get public transport, and one of the fucking questions on it is, do you or someone you know own a car or a small van? And you go, why does it have to be a fucking small van? You know, it could be any size van, right? Do you or anyone you know own a vehicle? You know, that's fine. You know, what about a medium-sized van? Because there's three guys that I know. We all share a van. We're called the 18, and we've all got COVID because we live in that van, and we're just breathing in each other's air and touching each other's eyes. That's why we're called the 18, because we are ace. I don't know. I didn't really think it through. It's not really a skit, is it? It's not something to be laughed about, potentially having COVID. So. I don't know. I walked home, but I had to walk through Wood Green and it was so busy. It's just like, I've definitely, you know what I mean? It's just like.
Definitely got it now.
You've definitely got the chance of having COVID just by a sort of like, if they're forcing you to take a test and then walk through places that are busier than where you spend 99.9% of your time. It's like, it's just me in my flat. You're forcing me to walk in a place where there's thousands of people milling around a shopping centre. It's just like, for fuck's sake. But, you know, anyway, so I'm waiting for my test results. So we might find them. We might get them live on air.
That would be great.
That would be absolutely great, wouldn't it?
Natalie is already thinking, absolutely perfect for a clip, right? Terrific.
Absolutely perfect. Well, yeah. I hope I do get the results within an hour and a half. Obviously, for my personal life, I hope I'm, you know, negative. Oh, for the purposes of the show, I hope I'm negative. But for myself, I hope I'm negative. But for the purposes of the show, I hope I have, you know, what, 1 week to live.
An all clear, so you can punch the air.
Punch the air? I'm punching the airwaves right now. See, punching the airwaves. If I only last another week, we'll get one more show out of it, or at least the first half hour. That'll be the farewell show. And then also, I'll still be in my 30s. So,
that's true.
So I'll be just more like
tragic. You'd sort of still more be young. Would that still count as young?
Yeah, it would be like James Dean, only more tragic, don't you think? Because James Dean was like 21, wasn't he, or 22?
Yeah, he's a young fella.
Whereas I'll be like old.
At what point does that, is it no longer like, oh, that's really sad? Or is it like, how old do you have to be where it becomes like, well, they had a good innings, and how old is oh, that's tragic?
I don't base it on age. I base it entirely on how much of a cunt you are. Play that song.
Nick and Nat's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
What now? Are we back now? All right.
Now. Hello.
What are you meant to be doing?
We are back. I'm trying to do two things at once.
One.
Right. Nick is eating his salad. I'm trying to pause the song from going into the next song. We are back. What should we do next, Nick? I'll tell you what I've been a fan of this week, Nick. I've been a fan of From the Oast House, the new Alan Partridge podcast, which I've listened to all of it, which is about 6 hours, 45 minutes. And it is very, very good.
I'm back. Sorry, guys. What have you been a fan of this week, Nathaniel?
I was just saying that I was a fan of From the Oast House, the Alan Partridge podcast, on Audible.
Right.
You probably listen to it, but you can't figure out your
order thing. I can't. And do you know what? It's not my fault. I went on Apple support this week. Mm-hmm. They've sorted out my desktop. I need to take my laptop in to be fixed. And my phone got nicked in January. Mm-hmm. They sent a replacement phone. And the problem with the phone is that the aerial is broken. So the internal aerial that's inside your iPhone.
Oh.
That never worked, right? So you need to be able to log on to the internet. So I've just been running off 4G this whole time, right? And you need to be able to run off the internet in order to listen to Audible. So all this time I've just sort of like gone onto Audible and then I've given up because I can't get it to work. And it's just because now that I know my aerial's broken, there's a problem with my phone. It's not me, and I can get that sorted. Now, interestingly, everyone always recommends podcasts to me. I don't really like podcasts, so it's a bit of a waste of time.
It's turned into a podcast.
No, I listen to this live religiously, but as a podcast, I can't be bothered. I listened to a few podcasts this week. One of them was the Ron Burgundy podcast from beginning of 2019. Started listening to that. Now, it did occur to me that From the Oast House is sort of like potentially a similar sort of thing. But I'm sort of saving From the Oast House to when I actually start to respect the format
a little bit. It's very good. It does a really good job in being, you know, it's a lot better than it needs to be as well. It feels like they've really thought about it, and it also feels like they've got a real respect for that character to not let it ever be like, feel like it's a sellout thing, or it feels like to do it, they've done it, but they've also made it like, it's got lots of funny jokes in, as you'd imagine, but it also gives it a real kind of nice narrative arc across it. And it's sort of much better than it needs to be. And episodes start as one thing, and then by the end, they've sort of developed into something else. And often in kind of surprising ways that are kind of really neat and like, oh, I really didn't see that coming. They sort of have these like about turns in them halfway through. And
the thing about Ron Burgundy is that he's basically a character from two films, and he didn't do a run on stage, did he? He was George W. Bush. So he's basically done two films and then some guest appearances here and there, but he's a dormant character. So to bring that back to life as like a podcast, you go, yeah, sure. So he really, I wouldn't say it's better than it has to be. I would just say they've seen an opportunity and they've taken it. Whereas the thing about Partridge is, A, he started off on the radio. So, and B, his character is a radio broadcaster. So to sort of like dip his toe into the world of podcasts, that's sort of interesting. And they're still making TV shows. It's not like, what should we do with this character? They've literally just like gone, let's take this character in between TV projects and make a podcast out of it. So in a way, it's kind of like keeping the character alive in between TV projects, but circumnavigating Radio One or BBC Radio rather. And if you've got a character that's as big as Partridge and you can create content for it without having to go through sort of like a broadcasting house, then that's incredible. If you can get that out to like a listenership and also make money off of it, then why cut out the middleman and then just directly, you know, get content to people, I suppose.
And it's that thing where you can stretch that character, because he is a broadcaster, it's very easy to put him into these various different formats. And it never really feels like you stretch too far out of place, or it's like, how would he be there, or what would he really be doing there? It all makes sense.
Do you think he's wearing hair and makeup when he does it?
Don't know. I always imagine he is, but he probably isn't at all.
Well, I think he used to do that. I think he used to wear the wig for like, because the early shows was his actual hair, I think, that was sort of like combed over. But I think he used to wear sort of like a wig for stuff that he was doing that he wasn't necessarily seen for, to get him into character.
Yeah, I imagine it helps. I don't know if you'd need that as part of the process, but I imagine it's an easy way to feel like you're him, or to feel like you're being him. And the other thing I quite like about it is it never feels improvised in a good way. It always feels written. It doesn't feel like he could necessarily be Alan Partridge off the cuff all the time. It does feel very thought about, and there is that sort of backstory to him that feels like it's always very written and solid and makes sense and correspondence with everything else he's done, rather than being, I'm just a character and I'll say something as him and it doesn't really matter whether that contradicts something else.
I don't think that's what people enjoy about Alan Partridge. I don't think it's that people think, oh, it's just this guy that's talking shit. It's really well written. It's amazing. And the thing is, I think that probably a lot of it is written with Steve Coogan stood in a room with the Gibbons and improvising. And then they write stuff down and then they improve stuff. So it feels sort of like natural the way they've done it. But I don't think when you listen to Ron Burgundy, it's just sort of like, you're making this up and you're doing it in character. And there is a different skill to that.
Mm.
But it's not just sort of like, or it's not Alan Partridge starting a sentence and then you basically listening to a performer trying to work out how to end it. It's like they're well-written jokes and it's all sort of like nicely crafted. And there may be improv scattered in amongst that, but I would argue that out of all of the Partridge moments that are people's favourites, barely any of them are improvised.
Mm.
You know, they're all sort of like stuff that's planned. You know, Partridge is an amazing character, but Steve Coogan is like a perfectionist.
It's another thing that you listen to and it very much backs that up. You go, I mean, it's very clever, isn't it? It's very well done. Well, just again, that it feels like an Audible podcast series feels like it could be a bit more throwaway than other things. And yet it's not. It's very well done and is a very solid piece of work in its own right.
But I think that Steve is sort of obsessed with his legacy. Mm. And I also think that he's done throwaway stuff in the past. And I don't know if he... I don't know him really. But like, I don't know how much value... Once you've done that, you now think, well, if we're going to do it, we may as well do it good, right?
Mm.
I know how hard they worked on getting the film right, yeah. Where they just, you know, they'd rewrite it every day to make it as good as possible. I mean, that's all on the DVD extras, but like, it's kind of like, there's no point in releasing like a subpar project. Mm. And I think when you also look around, if you look around at his like peers and his contemporaries, and you look at sort of like the, not necessarily cash grabs, but there are some projects that other people have done that are out there that could have done with being reworked and rewritten and looked after more. You know, I'm not necessarily saying the David Brent movie, but you know what I mean? It's just sort of like there are projects out there where you just think if there was a bit more love put into this, then it would have been, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think that most of Partridge stands up as, most of recent Partridge stands up as timeless. And you go, there's just every single project has got something that you can go, oh no, that's the best Partridge moment. Where it used to be stuff from kind of like I'm Alan Partridge. And now it's just kind of like that, it almost barely gets a reference.
Yeah. Yeah. Your base level is very high as almost like to begin with, the starting point of it is already at a high level.
But there's not another character that's been around this long.
No. Or is it well realised, I think.
And even something like when you go like, I don't know, like Inspector Clouseau, and they were still making cartoon series and stuff after Peter Sellers was dead and other people played him after Peter Sellers was dead. And you go, yeah, sure. But like, but that wasn't kind of like, the initial performer wasn't the person that was performing it and writing it and creating it and caring about it. And I think that maybe it did go into a point where he didn't like the character anymore. Maybe about 12 years ago before the book came out and the film came out. But then that reinvigorated him.
Mm.
And then he just was just like, actually, you know, he used to say it's the albatross around his neck. And you go... Yeah, sure. If you look at it as something that you did in the past, which you no longer love. But if you think of it as like, actually, this is your legacy. This is going to stick with you forever. Mm-hmm. For every year that you're old, Alan Partridge is going to be 10 years older, you know. And it's kind of like, if this is going to stick with you forever, rather than fight it, why don't you just make it as good as it can be?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what he did. He stopped fighting it. And then he kind of like does all of his other projects, which he, you know, makes as good as he can, and then he's got Partridge to sort of like go with him. Yeah, I think it's brilliant.
Mm.
I still prefer Tony Farino, but I do love all of his characters really. So what else have you? Well, I'll tell you what I've been a fan of this week. I watched Holy Mountain yesterday.
Oh yeah, yeah. the Jamaican right. Holy Mountain.
How do you say his name?
Alejandro Jodorowsky.
Yeah, that's him. So I know him from the Dune documentary, where it was Jodorowsky's Dune, where basically this director, Mexican, isn't he?
Is he? I thought, where is he from? Maybe he is Mexican. Yeah, I'm not sure, actually.
He changed his name to appear Mexican.
Okay.
Sometimes spells it with an X and sometimes it's with a J. But his first name, Alejandro. And okay. His original, I watched the extras. He was originally listed as Alexandre, which sounded French. I mean, this is just the extras on the Holy Mountain DVD. I originally found out about him because of Dune, which was eventually directed by David Lynch. That's right, isn't it? I always get David Lean and David Lynch mixed up.
No.
So it's originally directed by David Lynch, which I think he did instead of Return of the Jedi or something like that. I mean, I'm sure you love it. I think it's a terrible film.
Holy Mountain?
No, Dune.
Oh, right.
Basically, he did so much work on Dune and it never got made, but it did all the rounds in Hollywood. If it wasn't for Jodorowsky's work on Dune, films like Alien and Star Wars and, you know, any science fiction that was made after 1970 basically wouldn't have got made, because or wouldn't be as iconic or what it was, because he just had huge books of like all of this research and stuff that he'd done. And I think that wasn't he working with H.R. Giger at some point? Mm-hmm. Wasn't that what Dan O'Bannon looked at? And then Dan O'Bannon became obsessed with H.R. Giger. Then he wrote Alien. And then Ridley Scott basically...
Sorry,
guys. He basically stole Dan O'Bannon's homework and made a career off of it. But Dan O'Bannon is the one that discovered H.R. Giger and brought him onto the Alien franchise. Anyway, so that's how I knew about him. If you haven't seen Jodorowsky's with a J, Dune, it's a great documentary about a film that never got made. But I think it's fascinating. And then there's this box set that came out, and I've had it on pre-order for 6 months, 7 months, 8 months. So it was a bit of a shock when the money came out of my account. And I was like, oh, God. I just remember, I saw the film Mother. Do you remember the film Mother? Was that Aaron Aronofsky? Mm-hmm. Darren Aronofsky. And I remember I saw that and David Trent said, or it reminded him of Holy Mountain. And I was like, I've never seen Holy Mountain. And I saw it was available and it had the box set. It's got that, El Topo, and another one, which I started watching. And then like a documentary about what he's up to now. So I started the box set and I watched Holy Mountain, and it it's not an easy film. I mean that in terms of content, but also format. It's kind of it took me like I watched it in one day, but it did take me the entire day. I kept stopping it. And I did actually feel that in stopping it and coming back to it, I didn't lose loads. But I just feel like I've never seen a film that's kind of like as open. It's not really open to interpretation, but it's kind of like it's got this very sort of like moralistic quality to it. And it's explaining kind of like a philosophy. And as you're watching it, you feel like it's weird. You feel like there's a guy's philosophy and it's being explained to you, and it's not like mind blowing, but the way that the film goes about it is sort of like really incredible. And I just really enjoyed that style of filmmaking.
It feels like you're definitely entering a different world. You're in his kind of rules. You're playing by his rules for 2 hours or 3 hours or whatever it is.
Yeah. But that's in terms of, I mean, it's labeled as sort of like a mystical fantasy or something like that. and oh, it's definitely a fantasy. And it almost feels like it's sort of like a version of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, where there's like these nine spiritualists or these nine leaders that get invited by this other leader to sort of go with him on this mystical quest, and they all go through kind of a moment. And because it was made around the same time as Charlie and I'm not even joking, it's made around the same time as Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, or Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, the Gene Hackman one. And so it has sort of like some aesthetics that are sort of the same. It's just sort of like this really adult, and it's properly adult and weird, and the animal violence is really uncomfortable. But it's this really interesting, weird, like visually iconic film, which I think it made me want to watch it straight away. Mm. Watch it again straight away, and maybe watch it in a cinema, because I think that would be really special. But there was that. So next I'm going to watch El Topo, which David Trent does not like. But I would, if you've got kind of like the stomach and the patience for it, then I would say that Holy Mountain is kind of like a real good film. One of the things I found out about it was originally written, John Lennon really liked it. So he got, whoever his producer was at the time produced it. He said, just make it happen. And John Lennon wanted to spend some time with Yoko Ono. So almost as a prank, he sold the idea to doing it onto George Harrison. And George Harrison said that he would do it, except for the fact that there's a scene where George Harrison was to get his arsehole washed out in a bath on camera. And George Harrison said, I don't want you to show my arsehole on camera. And Jodorowsky said, no, sorry, it's part of the film. So he replaced him with an unknown, right? who looks, he's meant to look like, they mention it on the DVD, but really, he looks like a cross between George Harrison and Ringo, right? And and he's this unknown. And if it was George Harrison, they would have made a budget, and he sort of like went against the grain and he kind of hired this unknown. He was prepared to get his arsehole out. And really, I mean, I must have rewound that scene 20, 30 times, and you can barely make out an arsehole, right? So that's disappointing. So it would have been weird if George Harrison was in it, but like, you can imagine that it's the sort of thing that he would have been in. The music is very sort of like Beatles-esque of that era. Mm. Well, it was 73, so it was like of the India era. It was sort of like, yeah. Anyway, absolutely fantastic film. I'll let you know how the rest are next week. But it's probably time to do some fan mail.
Fan mail.
Yeah, let's do some fan. Oh, also, I didn't think it was anything like Mother, but I think what David Trent has is he's got attention deficit disorder, and so what he meant was, like, Mother changes every 30 seconds. Like, the film, you watch it and it's one roller coaster, intense ride to the end. And that's sort of like the same with Holy Mountain, where something different happens every couple of minutes to keep him entertained. He said that the thing he didn't like about El Topo is that there's a large bit of it that's in the desert and nothing much happens. So he switched off and now he's got all start from scratch again. It's David Trent, what a man. Okay, Brian, take it away. Right, okay. Thanks, Nick. I'm about to start. Hey, boys, do you know anything about dream analysis? I keep having dreams that I'm at school. What could this mean, Chris?
Maybe you loved school. Depends if they're dreams or nightmares. Sometimes they're just anxiety dreams. Depends what you're doing at school. Maybe, I don't know, you ate at school.
How's it going, guys? What are your favourite things to put in burgers? Are you pickling or pickle out kind of fellas? I'm pickling myself, Don.
I'm pickling.
I'm pickling. Pickling.
But if I have the option of taking tomato out, I'll do it. Mm. I don't care who I offend. I actually do care who I offend. Please don't be offended.
Hi, guys. Can I ask you an honest question? I was playing a film trivia card game with some friends and I feel like I sucked the fun out of it because I was too good. Is there a tactic I should use to save my social life, Nicky?
Yeah, stop being an arrogant prick and just fucking enjoy the gifts of others, yeah? And try and take yourself out of the equation and just enjoy other people's company. What do you think, Nat?
I agree. I think that's a very good answer.
Exactly. Yeah, he agreed. Hi, guys. I'm loving the show. If you were up in a party, Doctor Who, why would you lay in a bee? If you had a TARDIS of your own, where would you take it, Sid?
Nathaniel? If I had a TARDIS of my own, I'd take it back to... I'd probably take it back and fix all the things wrong in my life. That's what I'd do. I'd change every element of my life so I don't end up where I am today. What would you name, Nick?
I'd take myself to just before you said that, and then I'd stop you there. And carry on. No, I'd go 15 minutes earlier and have ordered that Subway.
Hi, guys! Nick, your character in Loaded was called Watto. Is this connected in any way to Watto from The Phantom Menace? Interesting. No, my name, I think, was called Adam Watkins. I really hated the name Watto. Hated it. It was well paid, and I enjoyed the company mostly, and I enjoyed the show. But I cringed every time anyone said my character name.
Hey, Nick and Nat, I'm an episode behind, so please forgive me if this has already come up. We're talking of demons and with arseholes on their heads. Have either of you seen or read Preacher? There's a character in it called Arseface, who has what looks like an arsehole for a mouth after an unfortunate accident. It started out as a graphic novel, and there was a series made of it a few years ago. I'm a fan, and I recommend it. Keep on providing the five-star family fun-size content, Emma.
You know more about this stuff than me.
I'm aware of it. I've not seen the TV show, but I'm very aware of Preacher as a comic book, a very famous comic book. An Arseface, I believe, was someone who, in the series, was a kind of obsessive fan of Kurt Cobain, and so tried to kill himself in the same way, but didn't die, but just ended up with a hole in his face like an arse.
Oh, that's horrible.
Yeah. Heineken, that finally took the plunge and watched Deep Red, a.k.a. Profundo Rosso, a.k.a. The Hatchet Murderers, a.k.a. what that giallo film, what Nick and Nat keep banging on about, only smoking. I really enjoyed it, even though I was watching a version that continuously switched between English and Italian with subtitles. Quick question, do you think that David Hemmings as Marcus Daly looks like a cross between 1980s Paul McCartney and Peter Serafinovitz, or am I just being a cunt? I couldn't get the likeness out of my head once it... had occurred to me. Also, spoiler alert, that the kid's drawing put me in mind of a very different kind of graphic artist seen in Uncle, drawn by Errol, and which Andy subsequently found. Do you think Leila Vandenberg could have gone a bit more Argento in that episode, or would it have been a bit much? Love the show, even though your film knowledge puts me to shame all the best makeup.
If you're talking about the first episode of Uncle, that was Oliver Refson, I believe, that wrote it and directed it. Leila joined in with the writing a little bit later in the series.
He does look a bit like that. I can see it. I can see how you might mistake David Hemmings for Paul McCartney. And who is the other person? Peter Serafinovich. I can see it.
I mean, that doesn't make you a cut. They're all three good-looking guys.
Mm.
So they've all... Well, Peter Serafinovich isn't as old. The other, they've aged very differently, Paul McCartney.
You guys seem to like Dario Argento. Have you ever been to Italy? I'd be happy to recommend some good places to eat, Laura.
Please do. Okay, hello, gang. Oh, this is the last one. Hello, gang. I just watched Nick play Werewolf for the third time on Twitch. What have been your favourite online discoveries over the past year?
I've completed Cobra Kai and loved it. I mean, it has many flaws, but we all love an unexpected victory. Which 80s film do you think would be turned into a successful series set years into the future? I would enjoy seeing what happened to the cast of Splash. All the best, Fran.
Fine. I'm not really interested.
I think I kind of... I often do like those films where they are something set 30 years after, but they are regularly disappointing, I'd say. So I try not to think about them too much.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to see what happened to Rambo after Rambo 3, but not really so much after Rambo 4. Okay, so let's play a song and then get our guest on.
Okay.
Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
in the studio, we're not in the studio, I'm in my living room, and Nathaniel's in his, wherever he is, and we're now joined live, we're not live, but we're joined now by actor, musician, comedian, Charles Eston. How you doing?
I'm doing very well, how are you doing today?
Doing fine, waiting for a COVID test to come through, but apart from that, absolutely, I don't want to burden you.
No, I think that's gonna cover the whole rest of the interview. I don't see how we can go on with any sort of. Now, I wish you nothing but the best. Come on now.
That's nice. But you know, you'd have to be a pretty awful person if you wish me anything other than the best.
That's true, and I've always aimed not to be that. So I wish you the best. I'm having good feelings about this. You're not feeling poorly, are you?
No, I feel absolutely, well, I don't know, now that you start mentioning it. Today's your birthday.
Oh, yes it is. Thank you for knowing that, because I told you.
Yeah, you told me. And I told you, if it was me, I would have cancelled.
I asked if it was too late to do that. I totally forgot about that.
We should have saved all that gold for when we were live on air. I don't like doing anything on my birthday. What are you, like, outside of just enjoying myself, what have you got planned for today?
Well, my wife has a bunch of surprises in store. There's a bunch of packages. I have three kids, and they're all pretty spread out. My oldest, Taylor, is here in town, my daughter. My son's out in Colorado. My other daughter's going to school in Virginia. We're going to get together online somehow, on Zoom or something at some point. I got gifts out there in the living room that I'm looking at through the doorway here that I'm pushing back, opening my gifts so that I can speak with you guys. So that's how much I care.
Wow. I do feel honored, Charles. I feel like, so tempting. This is like Christmas morning.
A little bit. And I'm pushing it off to speak with you guys.
I feel a responsibility now to keep you.
Yeah. When do we start?
Exactly. I mean, I feel that there's such an amount of pressure now not to waste your time.
Oh, yeah, also I'm getting older too, so I don't have as much time as I had a day ago. We got to get this thing moving.
Where are you right now?
Right now I'm in Nashville, Tennessee, in my office here in Nashville. We're just a little south of Nashville, a place called Brentwood. And yeah, I'm getting ready to go back to Charleston very, very soon. I was there in South Carolina shooting season 2 of Outer Banks. So I've been sort of going back and forth.
That's your Netflix show?
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Did you live, so you're obviously in the series Nashville.
Yes, sir,
Did you live in Nashville? Did you film that in Nashville? Did you live in Nashville before that? Or did you move to Nashville to make it easier to film?
No, I grew up in Alexandria, Virginia, and then I went out to L.A. for years and years, like 23 years. That's where I had the family and the kids and everything. Grew up and got into high school, and then I got this show called Nashville that, yes, actually shot here in Nashville. And we just fell in love with this city, and so we ended up staying. So this is where we live now.
That's amazing. I filmed a sitcom called Uncle, and we filmed that in a place called Croydon. But that did not make me.
You did not stay in Croydon.
No, I didn't stay in Croydon. Nothing wrong with Croydon, but I didn't stay. And through performing in the show Nashville, you developed a music career of your own, right?
Yeah, well, I sort of resurrected it, would be the best way to say. I started off in music in college. I was in a band. I headed up a band and would write and perform with them, did that, stayed an extra year in college. I was having so much fun doing it. I was like, when am I ever going to get another chance to do this? So when I left college, all those guys in that band that I was with went on to become doctors and lawyers and stuff, as the country song says. So I went out to LA to be an actor, always thinking that I would run into another drummer and bass player and guitar player. And it just never happened. But I always was writing music and playing music. The very first job I ever did, I played Buddy Holly on the stage in London in the West End. I was Buddy, the man himself. And then later I was on Whose Line Is It Anyway? And I was always writing songs, ridiculous instant songs on that show. So music was always a part of my life, but it wasn't until Nashville came back around that it sort of, you're right, it lifted this pack up and I'm able to to do this thing that I always want to do in the first place.
Yeah. So go we've on. Just listened.
Oh, no, go on.
So we've just, sorry, we've just listened to your, I hate Zoom. We've just listened to your song on the radio. And it's a summer song, and you've released it in beginning of autumn. It feels like an absolute sort of summer tune. And I was just going, why has he released it in September? But like,
I released it August 1.
Oh right. Well, I think it's a great song. Have you been working on music? I mean, how much has lockdown affected you during this time?
Well, initially, it affected a lot. I was over there in England getting ready to do C2C. I'd already performed in Amsterdam and Berlin, and I was about to perform at the O2 Arena. And then we were going to Dublin and Glasgow, and we had to come home early. I mean, literally, I think it was the day before I was set on there, maybe 2 days at most. So that was done. So that just literally put the brakes on probably the biggest performance of my lifetime would have been to perform to headline on that O2 stage. I've been fortunate enough to play that stage with the Nashville cast. Very fortunate to play Royal Albert Hall, not only with the Nashville cast, but to headline there on my own. But this was a brand new big deal. And so that was the end of that. And I have to admit, for a while after that, sort of just, wasn't feeling the music. I've been going for a long time and going pretty hard between the acting and the music. So I just, like a lot of people, just took it easy for a while. But then after a while, these song ideas start creeping up in your head again. And we start doing this thing here called a Zoom write in Nashville, where it's just like getting together and writing with somebody, except you do it on Zoom. And I think a lot of people were hesitant at first, like, is this really going to work? But it ended up, yeah, it really works. And so I've written a bunch of songs not too long ago recently that on Zoom that I'm really proud of and really love. So music finds a way. It's kind of like the grass on the sidewalk or the plants that just creep up, even in those times that you don't feel super ready to write something, it finds its way.
And were you like in that time when you're in the UK and you're in Buddy, so, and then you're in Whose Line Is It Anyway? So your background was also as comedian, right? Or was it improv specifically that you're into? How did you get involved in Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Well, when I first went out to LA, there's not that much. You can't just go be in a movie, at least not as far as I could find out, or on TV. The only thing you can really just go do and get on stage at is stand-up. So that's what I did. I did open mics at the Comedy Store, at the Improv. And that was a lesson in a couple of things. First of all, I was brand new, like every brand new comic. Very few are any good. I wasn't very good. But I also realized it wasn't quite for me when I found this other thing called improv at the Groundlings. And by now we all know what improv is. It's a group of people making something up as they go along. For me, I'm a much more social person. There's a solitude about stand-up that maybe didn't appeal to me as much as the writing sketches and the doing improv. So anyway, I took some classes there in LA. And before I knew it, the first job I had took me all the way to London, where I played Buddy Holly. And while I'm there, I get the word about this TV show that I'd never heard of, and nobody I knew back in the States had ever heard of, this whole thing called Whose Line Is It Anyway? I had never performed improv on a stage for anybody that paid any money, or I'd never done it professionally. But I went in for a sort of a cattle call with a whole bunch of people to get a spot on this show. And lo and behold, before I knew it, there I was. And honestly, at that time, I didn't think it was ever going to mean anything to my career. Lo and behold, all these years later, it's meant everything to me, especially when we went back to the States and it picked up again there with Drew Carey and those guys. That paid for a lot of things that, where I'm raising three kids, that beyond that, and also some great friendships. And 30 years later, there we were again at Royal Albert Hall in a anniversary, three sold out shows. And so this little thing that had started, you just never know what's going to be meaningful in your life when you're starting out. But yeah, that's how that came about. If I had not been in England to play Buddy, I would not have been on Whose Line, I don't imagine.
It's such an odd jump from that, right? Because Buddy is the musical of the life of Buddy Holly, from going to that to being even in with a chance to be on Whose Line Is It Anyway. And it felt like over here, that felt like a big show. And the people on it, to us, felt like these are like the premier improvisers in the country. And so you must have been good at it, right? It's almost, you must have been good to begin with.
Well, I think a lot of it, I've always been a bit of a class clown, bit of a wise ass, always quick with a word that a teacher did not want to hear. And other than that, I think a whole lot of it, if I'm going to be honest, I mean, it was that I sort of the balls of youth. I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know enough to be nervous. And you're right, absolute legends on that stage. And I remember the first time I walked out there, and I was one of my first sketches with Tony Slattery. And I immediately felt like I had stepped on, like I was a pretty good tennis player who had stepped on the court at Wimbledon. And I was like, here we go. And he came right at me as he would, as he should. And I remember there was something he said within the scene. He said, we were playing a Shakespearean thing. It was scenes. And so they would change the direction. Now Shakespeare, now this, now that. And they said, now Shakespeare. And for some reason, I was holding up, he was holding me up and he wanted my shoes. I was wearing nice shoes. And he goes, and he called me a pretty unfunny young comedian. Pretty unfunny young comedian thou art. Or something like, and I was like, oh yeah, all right, it's on right now. And he made me lift up my shoes. He was holding me up and stealing my shoes. So I'm holding them over my head. And then Clive Anderson hits a button, he gets a suggestion, and they say biblical epic. And I'm already standing like this, and so I don't know what made me think it, but I said, bow before the shoes before you. And like and Tony Slattery does what the scene says, and he gets down on his knees, and he's bowing before me. And I said something like, you are a young man. You shall have 13 sons and call them Seth. And and so that got a big laugh. But in that moment, I always look back at that. He was about to own me on that stage, and suddenly that little switch of what the improv was about meant that I had the power position, and he went along with it, and from there on out he seemed to enjoy the scene as much as I did. So I have no idea. You're right, I look back and I could never figure out how I was able to do that, but I do think it was just a matter of being too young and dumb to be scared.
Because Whose Line Is It Anyway was one of my absolute favorite TV shows, and I think that we used to get it Friday night. And we also on Friday nights used to get Cheers, and you were in an episode of Cheers, right?
Mm-hmm. Man, you're going way back. That was actually when I went back to the States after having performed Buddy. That was the first real TV show I was ever on. Was I auditioned and I got this role on Cheers, where I even got to walk through that door. And everybody turned as I walked in. I said some line, and everybody turned and looked at me. I wasn't quite Norm, but and man, I got to tell you, that was surreal. That was like being in a famous painting, but coming out the back side of it. Like this thing you've seen. It says a lot about me that all I can think about is the dogs playing poker. That's the painting that came to mind. So of all the classics ever done,
it would be
of course.
It would be like sitting there playing poker with the dogs. But it was insane to walk through that door and to see it. It was like through the looking glass is what it was. And it was amazing.
And I think that's great. Because that's the answer you want, right? If you want to talk to someone, Cheers. You don't want to talk to someone who's blasé about it and going, oh, yeah, sure, Cheers. You want to go, I was in Cheers. Cheers.
And by the way, I mean, it was the final season there. So I think it had been on 11 years. So I was a pretty young guy, so it had been on my entire adolescence. And so I knew all those people. I knew that bar. So it meant a lot to me. Also taught me a real quick lesson was a bunch of us got hired because it was sort of a party episode. There was a party in the bar. And maybe six or eight of us showed up at the table read on the first day where you sit with the whole cast and there's a massive table and everybody reads the script. And I called every single person I knew to tell them I was going to be on Cheers, of course. And then we all come back the next day, and out of the six or eight of us, there was two of us left. They recast like six roles. And I was young enough to go, oh, I didn't even know that was a thing. That can happen. So from there on out, I never told anybody I was on anything until it was ready to air. And then I would I always felt so bad for those people. That's got to be hard because sometimes it has nothing to do with your ability. It's just they don't go with them. That doesn't look right here. So Anyway, I made it on.
Yeah, I got two other people fired for a crisp advert once because the people said that I was too obese to advertise crisps at this time in the country. So, so two other guys that weren't as fat as me fired because we were free. What year did you do, buddy?
We're gonna just move on from that story like it didn't happen.
Sure. What year did you do, buddy?
I think if I go back, if I had to do the math, I think I started. Well, here's the cool thing. I went over there and I started in some of the smaller roles. I started as a backup singer. I played bass in the stand behind there. I was the guitar player behind Buddy. So that took a little while, but I think by the time it was sometime 1990 or 91, late 90, early 91. So this is a long time ago.
But again, that was a huge show here. That was like ran for years and years.
It was massive, and it was everything to me that suddenly I'm on stage leading a cast and getting, and that was when the music came in handy because I could stand up there and play guitar and sing these songs. But man, that was also my lesson in how much Buddy Holly, I knew he's big over here, but he's real big in the UK. He has so much influence over the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, obviously the Hollies, you know, different groups like that. So yeah, I mean, you always hear that cliche if they were dancing in the aisles. I'm telling you, man, every night they were dancing in the aisles. So it was insane.
Yeah, I mean, I remember my dad growing up in my house was a huge Buddy Holly fan, and I remember we went to see that. I'm not sure.
Mine was the same way. He talked to me about. He said, "You can't know what it was like to drop that needle down on That'll Be the Day." And hear that. Nobody had heard a guitar like that. Nobody that was. He goes, "That was brand new." Yeah, but you're not sure if he saw me. And did you see it?
Yeah, I saw it. I'm not sure if I think I may have seen it in like 89 or 88 when I was
it started right around. You're right. That was the very, very beginning. Yeah, that would have been perhaps Paul Hipp, who was just, he originated the role over there, and he's just fantastic in it too.
Well, it's really weird to think that, the guy that played Buddy Holly in the Buddy Holly story was Gary Busey.
Oh, yeah. And he's just fantastic in it. I mean, it's easy to say that. Then you go back and you watch it and you're like, whoa. I mean, come on, that's Gary Busey. I know there's all the jokes and everybody laughs now, but there's a whole bunch of Gary Busey performances that'll knock your socks off. What's the one with Keanu? Point Break.
Oh, yeah. Point Break.
Yeah, but was he nominated or did he win an Oscar for Buddy Holly? He was at least nominated. Somebody's gonna have to check.
I think he was nominated. I know. Obviously, he's sort of like got his own reputation now. But even growing up, well, Buddy Holly's got black hair for a start, so even that's kind of like, a stretch.
Believe me, I know because I back in the day when I was doing that, I would get my hair not only colored, but permed. So I had a black Buddy Holly perm, and I can prove it by my wedding photos. God help my wife. She married a Buddy Holly without glasses and stayed with me ever since somehow.
If we flash forward then to when you started Nashville, at the back of your mind, did you have an idea that this might be a route back into music as well as like an acting role? Did you think, oh, this could be it, this could be... This is perfect for me because I get to.
I guess that before I even thought that, first of all, they felt like bookends to me. The first major role was where I got to do both. And then I saw this one coming. And to be honest, I thought that maybe instead of the show being a path to the music might actually be a path to me getting the show. The reason being is I had been hanging around a long time and I've been very fortunate to get some very cool roles. I mean, things like on The Office or Big Love or things like that. But I was always the guest star that did a couple, like 8-episode arc or something. I had yet to land the starring role and be a part of that cast, at least since I was very young. So I thought maybe, just maybe, all these guys that keep beating me out for that lead role, maybe the fact that I can play guitar, sing, and write songs might help me to land this one that I otherwise wouldn't be able to. And I'm telling you, it was an arduous journey anyway, landing it. But in the end, I was right. That's the thing that helped me get it. And then since the music opened the door to Nashville, then reciprocated and completely opened the door to music.
And does that feel, was there ever, when you got involved in the country music world, did that feel like a welcoming place? Or was there, did you face anyone being like, oh, this guy's an actor, he's not, he's play acting? Or did it feel like you were immediately kind of accepted into that world?
It felt immediately like acceptance in a way that sort of blew us all away. I think, first of all, we heard early on, when before they knew what we were doing, everybody was saying, don't make us look stupid. I think Nashville had been burned sometimes with a few projects where people had cowboy hats on and pieces of straw coming out their teeth and 1 foot up on a hay bale. And so they didn't want that. So they found out that we weren't doing that. And then they said, oh, in the casting of these things, these people are actually singing, actually, you know, doing this. So I think the place that really made me feel like that had to be the Grand Ole Opry. When we got to sing on stage at the Grand Ole Opry, I was under no illusions. I knew why I was there, because I got to play this guy named Deacon. But it's not so important. What gets you in the door is what you do when you're there. And even more than that, who accepts you in that place? Little Jimmy Dickens at that time was 93 years old. He was a friend of Hank Williams, and he had been there forever and was as big an artist over the years as you could have. He welcomed us with open arms, me personally. Vince Gill was another that made you feel like you belong there. And I tell you what, once Little Jimmy Dickens and Vince Gill says welcome to the Grand Ole Opry, there wasn't anybody that could tell me otherwise. And ever since then, we just felt completely welcome. I think that's why I stayed. It's always been that feeling of sort of Southern hospitality. There's two things you should find at the Opry is great talent and great kindness. And I couldn't have done anything without both of those. So I was very grateful to find those things there for me.
Well, country music and jazz, I guess they're two big American art forms, aren't they? They're like that you have versions of them in other countries, but it does feel like that's almost something which feels purely American. It feels like you can do a version and you have people that do, you know, that sing country songs here or in the style of country music, but it does feel like it's something born out of the States, and it's something, and for a country.
I think that changes, and you got to see, it goes back and forth. And I think more than ever, one of the things I'm most proud about is that Nashville seemed to have an internationalizing effect on country music, that it exposed this vast swath of people that might not have seen it or heard it otherwise, or might have categorized it as something much smaller and more narrow than they knew. And to think that we had any role in that at all is amazing. Because when you think about it, country music, the guitar, the fiddle, at root came from the UK and you know, and Ireland. And it's all those instruments came across the sea. That's all they could bring with them. And then they played them in the mountains of North Carolina and Kentucky and everything. And then all these years later, it comes back across the sea. And I think that's why country's being embraced again. You're hearing an echo of something that's began with you. It's almost the reverse for blues music. Blues music began in the Delta, you know, in Chicago, and it found its way over to England, where it became the British Invasion, and, you know, all the, whether it's Rolling Stones, Led Zeppelin, John Mayall, and then it comes back to the States, and we're hearing that echo again. So we fall in love with it there. Sometimes you got to go away to come back and be beloved. And I think there's something to that as well.
I guess you're hearing something that you recognize through a different ear. You're
hearing something that is familiar yet exotic, which is a really cool thing that it sort of sits in a different place with you, I think.
Yeah. I guess it's something in that way, like a comparison would probably be something like a spaghetti Western, where you're seeing something again, which is entirely an American art form, but filtered through a completely different culture, who shows it back to you and you go, oh, you could also do it like this.
Exactly that. It's just another angle that you would never have seen because you grew up with it. It even happens in small ways, like in Nashville, when people started to watch our show, there are people in the city that go, oh, that's right, Nashville's gorgeous. I forgot it's gorgeous because I live here, or maybe I never knew and never got the outsider's eyeball on it. So, yeah, that can happen.
Wow. We noticed you've done 3 movies with Kevin Costner.
Yeah, I did.
Is that just by coincidence, or is he someone you've gotten on with over the years that you like working together?
We are huge Kevin Costner.
Oh, me too. It was a coincidence that my wife was his assistant.
Okay.
That was the coincidence. And he was incredibly kind to her and to my family. And so early on, I would just go hang out and be a fly on the wall. Like when they were shooting Tin Cup, that was one of her first ones that she was his assistant full time on. And then eventually this show, he started inviting me. I was in The Postman, which I loved every bit of. And then 13 Days and Swing Vote. So, yeah, he was always really wonderful about that and a great friend to us both. So, yeah, I'm as big a fan as you can get.
Yeah, and he's someone else, isn't he? He's someone who's interested in the kind of legacy of the kind of Old West, and he seems to be involved in that world and kind of keeping that. You know, he's like one of those real sort of true kind of American movie stars. And he feels like he's both sort of modern and classic, and he's a real...
He's bridging a real gap here between old and new Hollywood. And of course, now he's got this show Yellowstone that is just massive. There's just something that rings real true about him in all those performances. I remember when I was doing Buddy, seeing, I guess it would have been Dances with Wolves there, and being just blown away, seeing it in a theater somewhere near Piccadilly. I forget which one. And then later, of course, while we were there, Robin Hood blew up, and that song, that Bryan Adams song, ruled the British charts for what seemed like a year. It was unbelievable.
Was that not a hit in America?
It was, but I don't believe it was quite the hit that it was there.
16 weeks. 16 weeks.
I think it's the record. I think it's still the longest running number one. Wow.
Got beaten by something, but 16 weeks, yeah, it was. So obviously, Kevin Costner directed The Postman. What is the difference between working with Kevin Costner, the director, and Kevin Costner, the actor?
There's not much. I will say one of the things about Kevin is that he is who he is always. Some people change depending on who they're with. If they're around more powerful people, they act one way. If they're around funny people, they act another. If they're around, you know, he's a solid, solid individual. I think that's called integrity, being one thing. It wasn't much different, as I recall. There's a passion for filmmaking and for storytelling that comes out of him. But it's also a lot of fun as well. There was one scene in Swing Vote. You obviously have to think less when you're just the actor. When you're doing both, man, you are operating on every cylinder. But on Swing Vote, he was in the scene. I was his Secret Service guard and his daughters. And so we're at a bowling alley, and he is in the lane beside me with this beautiful reporter, and they're slowly falling in love a little bit while she's interviewing him at a bowling alley. And I'm the Secret Service guy bowling with his daughter. And I knew that they weren't going to see where my ball went or if it hit any pins. And so but I was going to be on camera bowling. And so I thought to myself, all right, just don't look like an idiot bowling. Try to look like you have some kind of form at all, which I don't. And so because of that, I was using perfect form. And because I was using perfect form and didn't care where the ball went, of course, every ball I bowled was a strike. And not just a strike, but the loudest strikes I've ever heard in bowling alleys. So he's 8 feet from me trying to do a scene. And he's like, well, I don't know. I guess when my mother and father. Eventually they go cut. And he goes, can you maybe not bowl one strike? And it's always fun.
And could you do that the rest of the time if you're trying to hit a strike?
No, I couldn't hit a strike. No. There's a real Zen lesson there about
yes.
It. Like in golfing or anything else, it's not what you're aiming at. It's what you're doing right where you are. Let's turn that ridiculous story into a philosophical life lesson. Don't worry about the results. Don't worry what's – just worry about in that moment what you're doing. It's true with music too. When you're performing a song, just be there. Fully there performing it, and whether it strikes or gutter balls is somebody else's problem. Just got a little deep, right?
Yeah, I've had like writer's block for a few weeks in lockdown, and it's not often that one of our guests is, you know, interesting, but thank you very much. You've absolutely nailed that.
Oh, thank you. Well, yeah, sit down and write, pretend nobody was ever going to see it.
Good. That is so good, though. Right. Okay. Yeah. Brilliant. Tell us about the show that you're working on now, then.
Well, it's Outer Banks. I'll be honest. I've been a student of television and TV shows my whole life. You could track what shows I loved as I got older, whether it was from MASH to Hill Street Blues to L.A. Law to ER to Lost. And so I used to know that there's all these wonderful shows where these great casts, and it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody from that cast is going to go get another great role. So when I came out of Nashville, I have to be honest, I was expecting to wait a little while, and I was okay with that. I'll just do music while I wait and wait and wait for them to let me do another role. So I was a little bit shocked when about a year out, I got a call from these wonderful guys, Josh and Jonas Pate and Shannon Burke, doing this show called Outer Banks. Just like Nashville had a little bit of magic around it for all the stories I could tell you about how I got it. There's always these little coincidences. My mom calls them God incidences, but all these things. Outer Banks is no different because, to tell you the truth, for the last 15 to 20 years, my extended family, I mean aunts, uncles, cousins, 50 or 60 of us, every year we go to the beach for 1 week. Where would we go? Outer Banks. So the guy that lives in Nashville and has this Nashville script gets the script for Outer Banks. And it worked out. And I'm telling you what, we shot it all last summer, not this one. And while you're doing it, all I really know is that this young cast that they have assembled is fantastic. Not only are they fantastic individually, but they make this coherent whole of, they just really seem like a group of people you want to hang out with. And that's everything for a show like this. So I thought this just might do something. Of course, I had no idea it would come to be the show that knocked Tiger King off the Netflix throne and took over at number one for a couple weeks there. So it turned into this big smash hit over here, and I couldn't be happier. But no, actually, for myself, yeah, but also for them. They're just wonderful in it, and to see it all blow up is great.
But it's like bowling, isn't it? It's like bowling.
You're not wrong. I wasn't thinking about the strike of it all. I was just thinking about looking good on camera.
I'm trying to pay attention to what you're saying on your birthday, but that thing that you said about bowling has blown my mind.
That it's nice that a series like that comes along when you are thinking, well, I can just play music. It doesn't feel like you're chasing it.
Let me tell you something else. That same thing happened with Nashville. Oh, for years and years and years, I was chasing it, all in capitals, bolded and italicized. I was bringing it. And it's a little hard when your wife is Kevin Costner's assistant. I can remember sitting there going, yeah, I'll do this one day. Not knowing. I mean, I knew how high up we were, but when you're young, you can think anything. And over the years, like I said, I never had to worry about work. I was always good, but I was still going to auditions a little bit needy, sometimes more than a little bit, sometimes verging on desperate for reasons I did not need to be. And so suddenly one day it hit me, and I realized how good I had it. And I said to my agent one time, I go, here's the problem with me as a client is I don't really need anything more right now. I have this amazing family. I have these jobs I like. Anything else over and above this is really basically just gravy. And I said, now don't get me wrong, I freaking love gravy. Gravy is delicious. So go get me some gravy, that's fine. But I was no longer operating out of a position of need. And then I end up with biscuits and gravy in Nashville. So that sort of sense of just sitting back and being in yourself, it certainly helped playing Deacon. When I auditioned to play Deacon, if they had smelled a whiff of desperation, that was not that character at all. That guy had just seen it all, was just sitting back in the end chair. He was auditioning them.
Yeah. I'm just going to ask you about that. Because that period, you've almost answered it, but it just feels that period is really interesting, where you're a working actor for years and years, and you're successful by any means because you're appearing in lots of different shows. But you're kind of, I wondered that, are you waiting for something? Is there always this idea that what's the next big thing? What's the thing that's coming? Will that happen? Will that not happen? Will I get a big series? And I guess you're also working with people, temporaries, who feel like, oh, well, they've got a series and they're taking off and they're but like, does it feel like that at the time, or do you sort of almost feel like it's in the post, it's coming, you can feel it coming? Or
I always sort of bridge the gap between those things. I used to think that I'm going to be doing this forever, for as long as I live. So therefore, there's not a role that can stop me. So like, there would be a role that maybe I didn't like, or some bit of material, and my agents would be, you need to get in this. This director, I'd be like, I'm good. And if you ever, I always sort of try to operate opposite of fear. In other words, fear is almost my reverse polar north. So like, if I'm afraid to do something, that sort of makes me go, well, maybe I should do that. If I'm afraid not to do something, then I go, well, maybe I shouldn't do that. I don't like that feeling. So in a lot of ways, I would just sort of react against that. I go, if I need this show in order to make it as an actor, I shouldn't be an actor. So that would free me up just to sit back and more concentrate. And by the way, you don't have to be an actor to do that. There's people waiting their whole lives for the thing that's going to make their life, instead of realizing they're living your life. This is your life. So yeah, I finally embraced it fully, and it made a big difference.
I think you have that tradition as well. But it is, yeah. But it feels like over here you have that tradition of sort of Shakespearean actors and things who have that thing where when they're young, they've got certain parts that they play at that age. And when they hit another point in their life, they're going, we'll now be playing these type of characters. And when I'm older, I get to play these kind of characters. And it feels like there's a whole life ahead as soon as they start. If they think of themselves as actors, you almost embrace the idea of, I'm going to play all these actors across, all these different characters, sorry, across maybe, if you're lucky, 50, 60 years of the rest of your life. And you get to play kind of older parts and younger parts, depending on how old you are. And that was quite a nice life to think of it like. You'll just get to play all these different people.
Yeah, if you can pull it off, it's amazing. I always, when I was younger, I look at these young actors I'm with on Outer Banks. I don't know how they did that. I was not that good for a long time. So I don't know how you come out of the gate being great. But slowly you learn things. I always felt like, I remember when I went to be a carpenter early on, when I was trying to raise money, I was a carpenter's helper. And I went and bought a toolbox with a new hammer, a new saw, and you got all these, and you're real proud of them. And you show up on the day and you see all these actual carpenters with old toolboxes and old hammers and old saw that have actually been used there, you know? And so you feel a little now embarrassed. That's how I always felt. I thought my tools were brand new, still had stickers on them, you know, price tags on them. By now, I get to show up to a set. I got that old toolbox. I have done the scene where I pull up in a car and get out angry. I have done the scene where I, you know, say goodbye to my wife. Real nice to get to have done this long. And yeah, I don't know what's coming next or if anything is, but I'm all right with that.
Do you feel more so that you've also got the music career? So you've got this whole thing where if there's something you don't want to do, you can go, well, I'll do this for a bit, or I can. And if you get to the point with music where you think, well, I've done enough of that for now, you've also got the acting, you can kind of, you've got this dual career. Does that help?
Well, I think so. I have to admit, people have asked for a long time which one is more primary, which one's the deeper love. And I've come to believe it must be the music, because I have been in many a write. I would be in Nashville on Music Row, writing a song with a couple guys, and I'd look at my watch and go, I got to go be on Nashville. Like, you know, back to the coal mine. That's just how much I love that. And I honestly, for all we've said about being an actor, there might be a day I don't get any more roles. I can picture that, but there won't be a day I'm not picking up a guitar and playing and singing or writing. So maybe that's a little bit more foundational and fundamental. But if something doesn't come along well, I would love to pick up the guitar, do some touring. I want to come back over the UK for absolutely sure. I would not mind that. It's a weird thing. Yeah.
Well, you said it before, but me and Nick are from like a stand-up background, and that's what I related to that a lot when you're saying that stand-up felt like it's something you can just do regardless. No, you don't have to ask anyone's permission.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's sort of the same way with being a musician, right? It doesn't even if you're starting out and you can turn up to an open mic night, which you could do as a comedian or as like a singer, or it's that sort of, there is something that you don't need to ask anyone's permission. You can do that.
I totally agree with that. And you found two places that you've been able to do that for a while. But the funny thing is that if you really think about it, permission is sort of an outdated concept. It's a thing of the past. As an actor, you can create whatever you want online. As a writer, you can write whatever you, you don't need studios. You don't need Hollywood studios. You don't need Nashville musical studios. You don't need labels. You don't need all these things. They might be nice. They're great vehicles to ride in. So that, I mean, my daughter's an independent artist as well. And she is fantastic. And I was trying to tell people what it's like as an independent artist. And I know so many. It's like, okay, walks the tightrope in the circus. And there's a point where everybody's just got the spotlight on her and she's up there being wonderful on the tightrope. The difference is these days, she had to set up the tent. She had to sell the popcorn. She had to sweep up behind the elephants. She has to break it all down afterwards. There's so much you're doing, but that's the work. The permission part of it is gone. Just go out there and do it.
And I think so much of the world is already like that and always was. There's so much of the stuff you're always doing for yourself, but it's almost that what's changed is you let the public in on that rather than it being a secret. That essentially what you're doing is a job, and it's not magic, or you're not magically appearing on a screen somewhere. It's almost letting people in more and saying, oh, I do a job.
When I talked about going to LA and I said all you could do at that point was open mic stand up, that's not true anymore. You don't even have to go to LA. You could do open mic stand up on your phone and do something so viral that more people see it than any movie I've ever been in. It's insane. So yeah, it's a new world.
Really is.
Yeah.
Right. What time are you?
We're
doing okay.
Run through a few of his favorite things and then we should do the game, yeah?
We should, yeah. So okay. What kind of things are you enjoying at the minute? What are you a fan of at the minute, Charles?
You're talking about across the board or
across the board? Yeah.
Yeah. I just got hooked on this show called Alone. It's one of those outdoor shows. I believe it's on Netflix. And you've seen the ones whether it's Naked and Afraid or there's different where you're put in the woods. This one seems to me to be the ultimate one because they take 10 people and they're allowed 10 different items, whatever those are. And then what it is it's last man or woman standing. It's everybody can tap out anytime they want. So I don't know. I generally like to watch fiction, watch stories. I'm a big fan of those. I've done Ozark and going back, Breaking Bad and all those. But sometimes you just like to watch those individual ones like that. I have to admit, it's very cool to be in love with your own daughter's music. My daughter's name is Taylor Noelle. Noelle, and she has a new song called West End, which is not about your West End. It's about this West End, but it could absolutely be about that West End. So she just was part of an online festival. That's how festivals are these days. And it's really blown me away to watch her, not just with the music, but with the videos as well. So that's something that happened the last two or three nights. Other than that, we've been cooking a little bit more than normal, too. We've been making some things at home and finding some recipes and making those happen. I'm a real steak guy, so I've been perfecting the steak. I don't know what else. Other questions?
How do you cook a steak?
Well, there's this thing called reverse searing. Have you heard about this? You thought the other stuff blew your mind. Reverse searing is, you know, everybody from when I would ever hear it, you sear a steak, you take a steak, you put on the thing, and you basically char it real quick, and then you cook it long and slow. This is the opposite of that. It says, first of all, you dry it out, make sure it's nice and dry. Then you cook it in the oven at like 225 for like 40 minutes or something like that. So you get it like 15 degrees below where you want it. So it's cooked nice, right, almost where you want it. And then you put it in a really intensely hot cast iron pan with like maybe avocado oil because it won't smoke. And then what you're doing is that sears the outside, but the inside is perfect. I would always end up burning the outside too raw and the inside or cooking through. This reverse sear, man, I don't know how we got on it, but it's nice.
Avocado oil is quite famous, quite big in America at the moment, isn't it?
Oh, avocado is maybe on the backside of its moment. The whole toast thing, I think, for the younger kids. I've had maybe one avocado. I had a bite of my daughter's, but she loves it. They all love it. But we just found out that there's some oils that you put in a pan and immediately become smoke. And so you're looking for one that doesn't, and that's avocado oil.
Yeah, I keep meaning to buy some avocado oil, but yeah, I can't find it anywhere. But yeah, brilliant. Okay, good. We're going to play a game with you now, and then we're going to say thank you.
Sure.
So take your game, Daniel.
This is the game, Charles. It's called Better or Worse, and you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person before, based entirely on my opinion. Okay.
Wait, I have to guess what you think?
That's right.
So this is not me making opinion statements, right? This is me guessing your opinion, not knowing you at all except for the 45 minutes we've been talking, 50 minutes. Okay, let's do this.
You've nailed it. Chris Rock, comedian Chris Rock, is he better or worse than Dwayne The Rock Johnson?
He's better.
Better. Chris Rock is better. Don Johnson, better or worse than Dwayne The Rock Johnson?
He's better.
He is better. Boris Johnson, Prime Minister of the UK, better or worse than Don Johnson?
Worse.
Worse, correct. Boris Karloff, better or worse than Boris Johnson?
Better.
Better. Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon, is he better or worse than Boris Karloff?
I said worse. I think he's
better.
Worse.
Because he messed up his line.
He's just a guy who went in a rocket. Sam Neill, better or worse than Neil Armstrong, the first man in the world?
Worse.
Well, if you're going to call him just a guy that went in a rocket.
No, versus he's been in a rocket. In a rocket once.
Here's my Sam Neill seeing dinosaurs.
Yeah. I hate that bit.
I love that bit. I stole it in an episode of Outer Banks, dude. You can look for that.
Oh, that bit! Yeah, I love that bit!
Yeah. All right, I'm going to say he is... I think you think he's worse.
He's better. Neil Armstrong.
Sam Neill!
He's winning a rough
Sam Neill! Sam Neill was in...
If Sam Neill was here, he would tell you are out of your mind. If you think all he did was ride in a rocket.
It's not Sam Neill's opinion, though, is it? It's not Sam Neill's opinion.
But I can call your opinion stupid. You make it sound like it's an infant in a car seat going to the moon. Okay, I'm being judgmental about your judgmentalism. Let's move forward. What's next?
Sammy Davis Jr., better or worse than Sam Neill?
Better.
Robert Downey Jr., better or worse than Sammy Davis Jr.?
Worse.
I'm trying to know your mind on this, and I'm going to say worse.
He is worse. Richard Nixon, better or worse than Robert Downey Jr.?
I'm still trying to picture Sammy Davis Jr. as Iron Man. Richard Nixon is worse than Sammy Davis Jr.
True. Robert Downey Jr.
Robert Downey, he's worse.
Richard Pryor, better or worse than Richard?
He's better than everyone.
He's done well. That's an eight. That's an eight.
It's an eight. You scored eight. You scored eight, which isn't as good as Jen Brister, Jason Manford, Joey Skidadanki with 10, Ken Cheng, Harry Hill, Luke Morley with 9, but it is as good as Susie Dent, Magical Bones, Samantha Morton, Chris Starts, 2 Whiffen with 8, and better than James King, Henry Normal, and Johnny Vegas with 7. So you've done respectably there.
I prefer to think the misses were your misses and not mine.
It's true.
If you'd have been a bit more relaxed about Neil Armstrong, you'd have done a little bit better.
I think if he had been British, he would have been the number one on your list. A British astronaut's a whole different ballgame.
I'm not sure. Boris Johnson rated fairly lowly. That was amazing, chat. Thank you so much.
That was great.
Thank you so much.
Happy birthday. Enjoy the rest of the day.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it, guys. Thanks a lot.
Stick around afterwards just for a second. But until then, we're going to play a song and we're going to play us out with a bit of Scott Walker. Do you like Scott Walker?
Play it.
Adios!
It's your bicycle bells.